history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. You might not always recognize them as such, but they are there. And when we take the time to listen to some of their stories, boy, does it add to our perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and really inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know we're going to be today in Dallas, Oregon, with 91-year-old Mel Christie. That's Dallas, Oregon, not Dallas, Texas. I spent some time at the sprawling campus of the Dallas Retirement Village. It's just west of Salem, the state capital. And in the weeks to come, we're going to meet some more vets enjoying life there at DRV, as they call it. But today, we're going to hear from a veteran of the 10th Mountain Division and a recipient of the Bronze Star. But as usual, I want to start before the military ever even entered your mind, Mel. What do you remember about those growing up years in Benton County, Iowa? What was that like, experiencing the Great Depression and everything else?
Yes, it was during the Great Depression. Almost all the farm people were in the same situation. They had nothing. We did have food, of course, because we were on the farm. But there was no money. Very sad. Most of the farmers lost their farms, too. If they hadn't already owned them and had a mortgage on them, of course, the insurance companies and banks foreclosed on them. So everybody was pretty much in the same spot. We were just flat poor. That's what we were like, yes.
What did you guys grow on your farm?
Basically, corn, oats. Back then it was clover hay for feed the farm animals. The farm animals, of course, were cattle, hogs, and my dad still farmed with horses, of course. That was before we had tractors. Goes back quite a few years.
And I bet you had quite a few jobs. What did you have to do around the farm?
Oh, always had to help do the farm chores. I learned to milk cows when I was just a little kid. And of course, even as soon as you're big enough to walk, you got to feed the chickens and so forth and gather the eggs. Little tasks like that. Bring in wood for the stove. Just all kinds of tasks. Everybody had a job on the farm.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember what your dreams were? What kind of ambitions you had?
I don't ever recall having any dreams. Just looked forward to going to school and letting happen whatever happened. No, I had never had any plans until the war came along and changed everything. Then, of course, one benefit that came out of the war was that I got to have a university education thanks to the GI Bill. Otherwise, I probably would not have gone beyond high school.
I'm glad you brought that up, because so often we hear about how the war changed everyone's plans, but in your case, even though everything you went through, you got something out of it on the backside. Tell me about December 7th, 1941. I'm guessing you were still in high school, huh?
I had just graduated in May. I was 17 years old when I graduated from high school. We were attending church on Sunday morning, and we came out from church. The man that lived across from church came out all excited, telling us what he'd heard on the radio. And that's when we first heard about Pearl Harbor.
Could you grasp that? Did it make any sense to you, or was it kind of out of this world for you?
Well, it's hard to understand us being attacked by another country, and I've often thought after, what on earth were those people thinking, that they actually thought they could attack a country like us with all the power we had? How on earth did they ever in their wildest imagination think they could pull that off? And of course, we thought right away it was just going to be a little skirmish and it would be over with.
So it didn't occur to you at the time that you might become involved in this?
Oh, no, not really, no. That was far, far out of anything I was thinking about.
When did that change?
Well, when they called from the draft board and said, Uncle Sam has a job for you.
How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, as a young person, it's kind of exciting. You think that you'd get to put on a uniform and march, you know, and all that. Well, yeah, you're going to be kind of proud to be a soldier, yes.
Was there any thought in your mind that you'd rather be in the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Air Corps?
No, I never wanted to be in the Navy because I'm not a big fan of water.
How do you feel about snow?
Snow? Well, I've shoveled a whole lot of it in my lifetime.
I'm sure you got plenty back home in Iowa, and you would see a whole lot in Italy with the 10th Mountain Division. Tell me about how you ended up in the 10th Mountain Division, and were there some moments where you wondered what you got yourself into?
Oh, definitely. Well, I joined them as a replacement. The 10th Mountain Division trained in the Rocky Mountains in snow and bitter cold. I trained on the flatlands of Texas and then was sent to Italy as a replacement. I arrived in Italy about the same time the 10th Mountain Division is, and the first battle they went in, they suffered many, many casualties, and I was one of the ones that was sent into the front to replace the casualties.
And I've talked to a lot of guys in that situation before, whether it was there or at the Bulge or somewhere in the Pacific, and it always fascinates me. Doesn't that occur to you? If I'm a replacement, something bad happened to the guy I'm replacing?
Well, the strange thing about it is, you know, if you had trained with those people, you'd have some buddies. But when they truck you up to the front in the mud and rain at night, you do not know one person. They take you up the front and you dig in a foxhole and in the mud and cold and wet, and you do not know anyone. You don't even know your platoon leader at that point, and it is a very desperate, lost feeling.
I can imagine. And so this is a rifle platoon, and you just described some of the conditions that you're dealing with as far as the weather and the terrain. So when you went to sleep that first night, could you sleep? What was going through your head?
No, not actual sleep. You kind of drift off a little bit, but you get very little rest on the front. It's a situation that's hard to describe. Combat is just different.
And how long did it take for you to be indoctrinated into that new life of combat?
Well, a few short hours, because there's pretty much of a routine on the front in Italy. The German army seemed to have a fixed schedule. Usually about daylight when artillery barrages would start, and then after the artillery barrage, some type of an attack, and you could just pretty much set your watch, if you had one, by what they were going to do. And of course, your best weapon other than your rifle is an entrenching tool, because we spent all of our time digging in the ground. And of course, in the mountains, digging into rocks for protection from the artillery and the small arms fire, anything to protect yourself.
I apologize if this sounds like an obvious or stupid question, but were you afraid? Were you scared?
Oh, definitely scared spitless, because, you know, you're pretty sure you're going to get killed, because the small weapons fire, other than the artillery, of course, is terrible, but the Germans were equipped with lots and lots of automatic weapons, a lot of machine guns and automatic weapons, and of course, it was typical combat. As long as you had yourself dug in the ground and the artillery airbursts didn't get you, why, you might survive another day. But obviously, you're afraid. The one thing I always worried about is, what would my parents think when they got that telegram or whatever the War Department used to notify the parents, what they would think? Because at that time there was censorship. My parents didn't even know where I was and what I was doing. They knew I had gone overseas. They didn't know where I was or what I was doing. But the only word they would ever get from me would be if if something happened to me, they would get a telegram or some kind of a notice that we are sorry to inform you that your son, PFC Melvin L. Christie, you know, and I always worried how that was going to affect them, because my mother especially was very, very concerned about me going. When I left from basic training, visited home, they knew that I was going to be going overseas someplace. They didn't know where. But it basically ruined my mother's health for a period of time, which would be typical of any mother, I'm sure.
I'm sure there's some mothers listening right now that have sons and even daughters that are deployed at the moment that are experiencing something similar. So you were more concerned about your mother than yourself, it sounds like.
Yes, I was. I was concerned about the fact that I could not communicate with my parents because, you know, censorship was such, so we didn't dare to tell them anything. And, of course, we didn't have much to tell them anyhow. The thing I was experiencing, I wouldn't be wanting to tell them about anyhow. So
I'm sure you've heard the expression over the years, and as you talk about some of the fear that you felt, the anxiety for your folks back home, I'm reminded of that expression so many guys have shared, that there are no atheists in foxholes. Is that something that that you experienced?
Yeah, that's very true. I have told many people that I think, you know, you always ask, what makes you think you survived when so many others didn't? You see, I went through combat without even a scratch. And I've always said I gave credit to my mother's prayers for getting me through this situation.
What are some of those moments that you look back on now and you see how close you came and you say, yeah, Mom must have been praying again?
Well, you know, as you move forward, in Italy, we were sent into the toughest situation because the Germans had dug into the North Apennine Mountains. They had all kinds of bunkers built into the side of the hills, and all of these bunkers were equipped with automatic weapons, and we always had to be going uphill against those. Now, there's no way a human being can get up out of a foxhole and walk up a hill against a situation like that, with the air just full of bullets and people dropping here and there. And yet, you go up through that situation, sort of firing your weapon without any specific target, just covering fire, and after the skirmish is all over, you're still alive. How do you explain it? Why me?
I imagine you were in some situations, whether you were advancing like that or in a foxhole, where artillery came pretty close to you.
Very early in my experience, I woke up one morning and found a piece of shrapnel in a foxhole in between, right next to my legs, piece of shrapnel from an artillery burst that was in my foxhole. That's how close I came to getting hit one time.
And unfortunately, I'm sure that if you were in combat in that part of the war for that long, there were days where you found out that someone else was not as fortunate as you were. How did you deal with the losses around you?
Well, you just kind of take it in stride. My good friend, I developed friends, of course. In the infantry, we used a buddy system. There were always two of us paired together. My friend was from Duluth, Minnesota. Swede, we called him, because he was of Swedish heritage. He survived all through the mountains with me. And in the Po Valley, it's just flat as the top of a table. We would go from, they had hedgerows, much like in France. We would hide behind one hedgerow, and then we'd get up and run to the next one. We learned in the infantry, you run and drop and roll, and then you get up and run some more. We were crossing this field of clover hay in the Po Valley, and when I got the other side, why, Swede was not there, so he had been hit apparently by machine gun fire. So that was a great loss, to lose your good buddy. But that's the way it was, just day after day, combat, typical combat.
In 114 days of combat during World War II, the 10th Mountain Division saw more than 4,000 soldiers wounded and approximately 1,000 killed in action. Mel Christie is one of those who survived, and we're going to hear more about his experiences, including what might come across to you as surprising interactions with German soldiers when we come back. To see some photos of Mel, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Mel Christie of Dallas, Oregon, originally from Benton County, Iowa. He served with the 10th Mountain Division in Italy during World War II in a rifle platoon with F Company of the 85th Infantry Regiment. When we left off, he was reflecting on the constant combat conditions in the Apennines in early 1945. Let's pick up where we stopped there. Mel, can you help us understand what that was like, what you were dealing with out there in Italy as a 20 and 21-year-old?
We all carried M1 rifles. The worst experience, of course, is in close combat, you get the order to fix your bayonets, and that is ugly business, of course. Hand-to-hand combat is, well, we just don't talk about that.
And I don't want to ask you to talk about anything you don't want to talk about, but can you give us a sense for how frequent of an occurrence that was?
Well, that's pretty much at some time during the day, every time we were advancing. We took those mountains just inch by inch, foot by foot. You'd have an objective. Those hills all had numbers. And for a certain day, you'd have your objective would be hill number 99, and you just fight your way to the top of the hill. There would always be counterattacks, of course, both artillery and small weapons fire and automatic fire that would try to drive you back off the hill. And when you just sometimes get hand-to-hand combat. Once we got into Po Valley, of course, then we had tanks and motor vehicles and so forth that we went across the Po Valley in just a matter of a few days. And then the war ended as we entered the Alps. And there's been so much written about the 10th Mountain Division. The 10th Mountain Division was the only division in the U.S. Army that was specially trained for mountain warfare. And of course, as I pointed out, I was not trained for mountain warfare. I just ended up with the mountain division. I was trained in the flatlands of Texas among the cactus and rattlesnakes and so forth, but I fit into the 10th Mountain Division because just plain climbing hills.
How did you feel about the enemy?
It's hard to really hate anybody. I think it's very unfortunate. I've done some writing about that, that I had often wished that I could go over on the other side of the hill and shake their hands and get this thing over with. It's a bunch of foolishness that young farm boys from Germany and young farm boys from the United States had to go and kill each other because some nut on one side had all these grand ideas about taking over the country. What I think we need to do, instead of training so many troops, is start training some diplomats, because most of these problems could be solved by diplomacy if we had people intelligent enough to do it and willing to do it. Because the other thing I felt so bad about the war is we destroyed so many beautiful old buildings, and I always felt sorry for the civilians. You know, the civilians, women and children especially, suffer more in a war than the armed forces do. We had it rough, but can you imagine what the women and children in these villages bombed out? We would see women carrying a few personal possessions and their children crossing no man's land. When the artillery wasn't flying, we'd find them trying to escape the situation. It's just tragic, the things that go on during a war. It's really tragic.
You mentioned being in the Alps when the war came to an end. How did you get that news that Germany had surrendered, and how did you and the guys you were with react to that?
We were very glad it was over with. We, as we approached the Alps, there's a beautiful lake called Lago di Garda, Lake Garda, up in northern Italy. And the road that ran alongside it, there was sheer cliffs came down to the edge of the water, and there were many tunnels. Well, as the German army retreated, they blew up these tunnels, so we could not advance. So we took to the water in ducks and made an amphibious landing at the top of the lake. The day we did our amphibious landing, the word came down that the German army in Italy had surrendered. The war ended in Italy sooner than it did in France. And our company, F Company, was trucked up to Bolzano, Italy, to help in the surrender of the German army, because that's where the German army headquarters were, in Bolzano, Italy. We were set up, and people do not believe this, but the day after the war ended, we were trucked into Bolzano, Italy, and we were accepting the surrender of the weapons and so forth. The weapons were being stacked in City Square, but we were actually walking down the streets of Bolzano, Italy, shaking hands with German soldiers. They were just as happy it was over as we were. None of them liked their job any better than we did. They were just doing what they were told to do, just as we were.
And I bet you were ready to come home.
Well, yes. Of course, the draft required you to be in it for at least 2 years or the duration of the war. So I still had a little time. In fact, we were not in Italy very long until they brought us back to the States on the way to Japan, because the war had not ended in the Pacific yet, and we were going to be part of the invasion force to invade the homeland of Japan. Well, fortunately, of course, because of a decision that Harry Truman made concerning the atomic bomb, I never had to get to the Pacific. And that probably, I know many people have said how bad it was to drop the atomic bomb on those people. From a personal standpoint, I think it probably saved my life, because otherwise I would have been a a part of the invading force of the homeland of Japan, and that would have been a terrible massacre on both sides, I'm sure.
And there's three daughters, six grandkids, and three great-grandchildren who are very thankful for that, I'm sure. When was it that you were given the Bronze Star?
Well, this is interesting because I never realized, I earned it sometime in Italy, but I never got it until about 60 years later when, for some reason, I was trying to get a copy of my war records, and I was told that they had been destroyed in a fire in Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, when a fire had destroyed about half of the military records. And when I moved to Oregon, they promised they would try to find my records for me, and they did. All of my records had been in the fire. They had not been destroyed. They had just been damaged by water. And as a result, I got a package from the records department with all the ribbons I had earned during war, plus the Bronze Star, which I had not been aware I had been awarded one until about 60 years after. Well, this is when we moved to Oregon about 17 years ago.
That means something to you?
Well, yes. It's nice to receive awards for our efforts. I don't recall anything special that earned it. I'm sure a lot of other guys. I have never discussed with our three daughters. They've never asked me any questions about my war experience, and I've never discussed it with them. If they happen to hear this broadcast, they'll probably hear more about it than they've ever heard, because we never discuss it. Well, I know they've asked me sometimes, and my answer usually is, I don't really care to talk about it. It's a strange thing. I've never been very proud of what I did, because, well, we think it's wrong to take life, and yet it becomes our obligation to go do it. It's still, we just don't feel good about it, you know. I have made the statement many times, if you hear somebody bragging loudly about their war experience, I would make the statement that they probably were never in combat. Combat veterans don't discuss what they did unless they are specific asked, because we don't volunteer it. It's just not something you brag about.
And I get the sense, too, that it's a burden that you carry, that you've carried for 70 years.
That's true. That's true. We always wish it'd been some other way. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if it had been some diplomat that could have sat down with Adolf Hitler and talked him out of all his aspirations for taking over Europe? However, I doubt if they could have, because I think the man was totally crazy. But the thing that concerns me more from a political standpoint is how in the world a man like him could ever become the head of the country. The people had to let it happen. Now you're going to get me on my stump preaching, so I have to be careful. It could happen in this country if we don't wake up, because we have become a country where people are dependent upon the government. Such a large percentage of people are now dependent upon the government that if somebody aspiring for an office in our government promises enough things to enough people, no matter how good or bad a person they might be, they could become the president of this country just because of that. What percentage of the Germans supported Hitler? Maybe, what, 12, 15%? I have no idea. But a strange set of circumstances. Our daughter attended a private college that part of their requirement to graduate was to spend at least one semester studying in a foreign country. Our oldest daughter studied in Germany, met a German boy in school, They corresponded for years. He later came to this country for an advanced degree. He is now our son-in-law. So our son-in-law is German. Our son-in-law's father was in the German army, and I've spent many hours talking through an interpreter with my son-in-law's father, and to hear it from their perspective, they didn't like Adolf Hitler either, but they had no choice.
I'm going back to what you told us about being in Italy and shaking hands with the German soldiers. I guess maybe that was a little bit of foreshadowing to having your daughter marry the son of one of those German soldiers, huh?
Well, it seems it worked out that way. You know, I am convinced that many, many things in our lives are a result of divine, how do I put it? I think the things don't just happen. There's a plan, possibly a plan for each of us. And if we follow that plan, why, things work out all right.
Well, I'm glad that plan included the opportunity for us to spend some time together today. We're nowhere near done with the show. If you want a face to match with the voice, visit hometownheroesradio.com or go over to Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio, and you'll find some photos of Mel Christie, not to mention all the other vets you hear from on Hometown Heroes. When we come back, we're going to hear about the experience that Mel had on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler. brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It's that time of year where we're all in the giving spirit, and hopefully our hearts are all filled with gratitude. Don't forget our men and women in uniform during the holiday season. When you end up gathering with your family, why don't you take a moment to think about those who can't be home for Christmas because they're in every corner of the globe serving our country. The veterans we hear from on Hometown Heroes all had to spend holidays away from their families during World War II, and they sure don't take it for granted now. When we come to the end of the year, I always look back at the incredible men and women I've been privileged to meet and putting this show together. A year can go by in a real hurry, but with every passing week, no matter where I end up in these United States, I'm even more convinced that there really are heroes in our midst, and their stories can be so powerful for us to understand and reflect on. Before I forget, I want to thank Gator Gaynor. He's the program director at one of the many fine radio stations that Hometown Heroes airs on each weekend. That's KYKN 1430 in Salem, Oregon. He told me, you've got to get out to the DRV, the Dallas Retirement Village, and meet some of the amazing veterans there. And he was right. We've been hearing from one of them today. Mel Christie has been in Oregon with his wife Mary Jo for the last 17 years. He's originally from Iowa, but during World War II, he battled German forces in Italy with the 10th Mountain Division. He mentioned that final engagement at Lake Garda, where they had to make an amphibious assault, and I have some photos and information related to that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. That was a pretty unique situation. But let's get back to Mel and his journey now.
Well, and you made reference earlier to how things worked out for you after the war. You expressed your gratitude for the GI Bill. So what did you get a degree in and where?
Well, I went to a small church-related college down in Kansas, McPherson College, to be exact, and I got a bachelor's degree in industrial arts education. I tried teaching school. I was not suited for teaching. I went into industry, worked in the building industry for a while. I specialized in electricity and heating and air conditioning, and I was fortunate after several years to be hired by an international corporation that manufactures heating and air conditioning equipment, and had a very satisfactory career in a management team in that international corporation. A very successful career in that, and a very happy retirement.
What was that company?
Well, it was Lennox Industries, the one that built heating and air conditioning equipment.
I've got a brand new one right outside my house.
I'm glad.
Well, and you said something a moment ago. You said that you believe there is a divine design or a plan for your life. So if you really believe that, I'm guessing that there's still something else that you're striving for. What keeps you going now? What plans do you think lie ahead for you?
Well, right now I have the responsibility. My wife and I have been married for 67 years. Unfortunately, she has gotten to the place where she can no longer walk, so I am more or less her caregiver now. So my main responsibility now is to see that she's taken care of and comfortable and meet her needs. And I don't have many other aspirations except to live to be 100 and establish some kind of a record.
What are you going to do to celebrate when you reach 100?
Well, probably take a nap.
Just not a permanent one.
Oh, my wife and I kid now about our routine here at Dallas Retirement Village. We eat, and then we take a nap, and then we try to get a little exercise, and then we eat again. And that's pretty much our daily routine now.
Something else I'm curious about. Have you had a chance to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. I was very fortunate. As soon as we moved here and DRV found out I was a veteran, they were sponsoring these honor flights to Washington, D.C., and I was very fortunate to be included in a group of three of us that went to Washington, D.C. on the honor flight, yes.
What did you think of that memorial when you saw all those gold stars there representing 406,000 Americans who died, so many of them from your division? What did you think?
It's very sobering, of course. It is a beautiful memorial, but I'm humbled to think that that many lives were spent making that possible. I'm constantly concerned about how can we keep from sending our young people to make that sacrifice, because we have many young men and women now in dangerous way. As we watch the news each day, it just doesn't sound good. And unfortunately, I don't know what the answers are. We apparently have people that just don't care for us, and they want to harm us. And we don't want that to happen, but diplomacy maybe is the answer to it.
With regard to that honor flight, I mean, the World War II Memorial is the destination, and it's the place that is the motivation to get you all you guys there, since it wasn't built till 2004. But that experience is a lot more than a little time at the World War II Memorial. What were the highlights of that journey for you?
Well, to visit, we visited more things, of course, in Washington, D.C. besides the memorial, but each branch of service has their own memorial in Washington, D.C., and to be able to visit all those was an interesting experience. And when you stop to reflect on what all was involved in World War II and how many people's lives were involved, it's just mind-boggling. But there's many beautiful things in Washington, D.C. I'm sometimes concerned about our leadership, both in Congress and in all branches of the federal government, that hopefully we can get good people in those positions that will represent us properly. And of course, it emphasizes our responsibility to vote in our elections and try to see that the right people get in. Because if we don't, we will live with the results, whether we like it or not. It is true that a minority opinion can elect our leaders.
Well, and you fought for our right to vote, and many people died for it. So that does put it in perspective. I guess one more thing on the honor flight. I know that there are a lot of planned activities in all the destinations, the different memorials you go to. Were there any unplanned moments that got your attention, that spontaneous interactions with people that made you feel like you did something worthwhile?
Well, nothing that I can think of, except we were very warmly received every place we went. We had a very interesting experience in Chicago. We changed planes in Chicago, and I was surprised that I got off of one plane and started walking down through the airport. I was walking through a column of sailors on both sides, standing at attention. And what had happened? You know, Great Lakes Naval Training Station is in Chicago. And a large contingent of those young men and women had been at Chicago O'Hare traveling someplace. And they heard about our group coming through, and they stood at attention and welcomed us. I have a picture of me walking down through this column of all these young sailors standing at attention. So we were welcomed like that every place we went. And when we arrived back in Portland, every place we went through an airport, people were stopping and cheering us. So we were honored at all points during that trip.
Well, they were all trying to say something that I'd like to say, which is thank you for serving our country, and thank you for going there with us and telling us some of those stories that you haven't shared so much over the years. There's one more thing I want to ask you, because you made a point of how your mother suffered while you were overseas, the anxiety that she dealt with, and that it was her prayers that you feel got you through. So I've got to ask you about that moment when you made it back to Iowa and you got to see her again. Can you tell us about that?
Obviously, it was a very happy time to, well, back then, of course, we traveled by train to get off the train and be welcomed by family. Of course, at that time, I was wearing my, you know what a ruptured duck is, don't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wearing that little patch on my uniform, knowing that this was over with now, and I could relax and enjoy my family. You know, one thing a serviceman has trouble with when he comes home from the service and sits down at the family table, we have to be a little careful about our vocabulary. You can't say pass the butter, you know. You have to stop and think, now what's the right word for butter? Yeah. No, really. Transferring back to civilian life takes a little bit of doing. Of course, I was fortunate. I did not have a girlfriend when I went off to war. So many of the guys were actually married, and some of them had children. And of course, girlfriends. A lot of them received Dear John letters. So I never had anybody like that. I had a pretty easy time of it in the service as far as personal relationships.
Well, and getting back to the plan, I guess there was a plan for you to meet somebody else that you've been married to for 67 years now.
Well, when I went to off to college, of course, at that age, I met a young lady in school. We've gotten along very well. Let's see. It'll be 68 years in May if I can make it around the corner.
What's the secret? What's the key to a marriage that lasts for 67 years?
Oh, you have to always be considerate of other people, and considerate of other people's needs and wants and desires. You don't dare to be selfish. If you're going to be married happily, you have to be willing to give and take. But it's been a very peaceful time for us. We get along very well.
Kind of sounds like you're saying your solution for marriage is the same as your solution for war, diplomacy, huh?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
I imagine I'm not the only one listening who can take that advice to heart, especially during this holiday season. Mel Christie, 91 years old, of Dallas, Oregon. Don't forget to check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com, including the one Mel mentioned of the sailors saluting him while he was on his honor flight. And speaking of that trip, Mel carried with him a Purple Heart. It wasn't his, but it belonged to a fellow veteran who didn't live long enough to see the National World War II Memorial. That man's daughter asked Mel to take it to Washington in honor of her father. I'm sure you can imagine how much that meant to her. And after hearing Mel's heart over the last hour, you know it was incredibly meaningful for him, too. This was a pretty philosophical conversation today, wasn't it? I don't know about you, but I feel like I hear something new every time, and that's why it's such a great privilege to bring you these hometown heroes and their stories, and remind you again in closing that freedom is not free. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.